The CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phones, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Are you ready, Steve?
Uh-huh.
Andy?
Yeah!
Bert? Well, all right, fellas. Let's go!
You're listening to CFRN, the Christian Financial Radio Network.
Today's broadcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/CFRN. Over 85,000 titles. Choose from mystery, romance, religion, science, technology, business, New York Times bestsellers, even children's books. You name it, Audible has it. With 85,000 titles to choose from, you're sure to find the perfect audiobook for yourself or to give as a gift, and it's absolutely free. Just point your browser to audibletrial.com/CFRN. That's audibletrial.com/CFRN. And become a part of the audiobook revolution by downloading your free audiobook today. audibletrial.com/CFRN.
Hey, trader, want to get rich quick? Well, good luck with that. If, on the other hand, you actually want to learn how to trade, the place to be is www.cfrn.net. Tune in Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern, for our daily devotional, and then spend the next 3 hours learning how it's done from professional traders who actually trade for a living. That's www.cfrn.net. Every trading day from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. CFRN, a community of believers who trade for a living.
Good afternoon, traders, and welcome back to the CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast. This is the daily broadcast of indeterminate length where we discuss all things E-Mini along with some really big ideas on the finer points of trading gold, bonds, crude, sugar, the euro, and even T-bills. Joining us today from our studios in Boston, Mr. Michael Bork. From our trading desk in Chicago, Mr. Burton Schlichter. And from our studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, Mr. David Williams. Now, to get things started, let's go to our host and founder in Studio A, overlooking South Mountain, America's largest city park. Here's Dwayne.
Good afternoon, perhaps good morning. Delete the appropriate. Welcome back. Today's Thursday, 16th day of August, 2012. Quick look at the numbers. Dow up 35, S&P up 4, comp up 14. Facebook not having its finest hour as shares come out of lockup. Last time I checked, gold was up about $10, and I have no clue where crude is this morning. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Dwayne.
All right, we have all present and accounted for. We will skip the normal pleasantries. If you want to just quickly kind of gloss over what transpired in the trading room this morning, we had some news.
Okay.
What was the news that came out? Philly Fed?
Yeah, Philly Fed came out.
Good,
came
bad.
Came out lower than expected.
Hmm?
Let me go over. I'll go over that really quick. And the Philly Fed, they were anticipating minus 4.7. It came out minus 7.1. We had housing starts came in at 0.75 million. They were expecting 0.76. Yeah. Unemployment claims, they're expecting 365,000. Came in at 366. Building permits, they're expecting 0.77. It came in at 0.81. So it's kind of a mixed bag with news this morning. Nothing good. Nothing real good anyway. Yes?
Yes. I guess that would be David.
It might have been David.
Good morning, Dwayne.
Hey, David.
Hey. Good morning, Dwayne. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Okay. Well, we were going to play your little theme song, but we'll just skip it now.
Well, you said you were going to dispense with all that.
Yes, all the pleasantries.
I wasn't going to dispense with that, but...
I can go back behind the curtain and you can do it.
No, that's okay.
No, that's fine.
We are gathered here early today, folks, because Burton Mulkeel, the author of the book Random Walk Down Wall Street, has agreed to come and chat with us a little bit and talk about his book and about his thoughts. His book was given a really good review by Forbes magazine way back in its first printing. It is a 400-page book, so I have not read the entire book cover to cover, I'm going to admit. But one of the things that Burton in the original book makes no bones about is that in Chapter 1, what is a random walk? And a random walk is one in which future steps or directions cannot be predicted on the basis of past actions. When the term is applied to the stock market, it means that short-run changes in stock prices cannot be predicted. Investment advisory services, earnings predictions, and complicated chart patterns are useless. Market professionals arm themselves against the academic onslaught with one of two techniques called fundamental analysis and technical analysis. Academics parry these tactics by obfuscating the random walk theory with three versions: the weak, the semi-strong, and the strong. So that's just a little bit of an idea as to where Burton is coming from with his thoughts on Wall Street. And that is quoting from, I think, perhaps the very first edition. It's now in its 11th printing, so some things may have changed, and we talked about that a little yesterday. So Bert Schlichter from Daniel's Trading, at the top of the hour, in about 5 minutes here, he's going to conference us in, make the phone call, dial the number, push all the proper buttons, request help from tech support if needed. Other than that, we got about 5 minutes to chat here, David. So anything you want to cover on the market that's happened so far today?
Dwayne, are you referring to me here?
Mm-hmm. You're the only David I got. It's your show.
Oh, well, just that the market has not been able to close below the, in our work, below the 1401 level, which we've mentioned to Bert and in a roadmap setup. So that indicates for us a continuing strong market with the likelihood of seeing 1416 or higher prior to the ending of the current advance that we're under right now. That, of course, requires the market to close above 1401, which they've been able to do each day here. So we'll see. If the lowest close we've had has been 1401.50, that was a couple days after we came out with the roadmap. So we'll see. It's very quiet. It's the summertime market. You know, we all know that the market tends to get quiet in the summertime. This is a repeating behavior that we've seen for forever. That during the summertime, in the heat, the markets tend to slow down, the volatility tends to decline, and the markets tend to just go quiet. They do have decent-sized moves within that summertime period, but the kind of trading that many of the day trading and swing trading types are looking for, the volatility, the explosive moves, is absent for the most part. So we're seeing that the market can climb very slowly during the day, and at the end of the day, you would look at the chart and you'd say, well, you know, look at that. That's had a really good day today. But it might not have been a really tradable day because the volatility was very low. The market still ultimately might have covered quite a bit of ground, which may well happen in today's session. So that's basically it. That's our outlook right now, that we'd be looking, with the close above 1401, we'd be looking for the market to make a test or an attempt at the 1416 level.
Okay. Let's see if we can get a quote on Facebook.
Yeah, and I could go into more detail, et cetera, but I know we only have a few minutes here.
Yeah, and we can once we finish talking with Bert.
Sure.
Facebook right now down 6% on the day, $1.29. Could have been a lot worse.
Well, it's not over yet.
No, it's not over yet, that's for sure. Volume, let's see, 69 million. Wow, that's, let me bring up a different screen. I'm not sure that's correct. Let's just see. No, that is correct. Average volume is 30 million shares, and so far today, in the first hour and a half the market's been open, we've traded 70 million shares, and we're down $1.30. So that's 6.18%. So what was the number that I said was going to be released today?
It wasn't the full 2 billion.
No, I think it was 241 million.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay. So of that 241 million, arguably, you know, well, we've seen 69 million trades so far. Now, again, some of these shares may be being sold off the market, okay, in a private transaction. So you won't see those go across the tape. The details of that will at some point be made public. I don't know when, maybe as early as the evening news tonight. We'll just have to wait and see.
Burton, are you with me?
I am.
Okay. Dwayne?
Yes.
We got your guest on the program here.
Well, Burton McKeel, thank you so much for joining us on today's radio program. My name is Dwayne. I am the host of the program here on CFRN. And on the panel with us, we have my esteemed colleague, Mr. David Williams from Page
Good morning,
Trader.
Bert. Burton?
Good morning.
Nice to meet you.
My associate, Mr. Michael Bork.
Good
and
morning.
You've already spoken.
Good morning.
To our friend and broker, and the only one in the crowd who was smart enough to pull off a conference call, Mr. Burton Schlichter.
Okay.
So thank you a lot for coming on the show. I mean, your book. I mean, what can I say? It's 400 pages in its 11th printing, read by so many people on Wall Street. Great reviews by Forbes magazine, just to name one, and some very provocative thoughts. So if you could just share with us a little bit today, kind of what your theory is on Wall Street, why it is a random walk, and maybe a little information just about who you are and how you got your background in the markets and what got you interested in the markets.
Sure. I have spent most of my career as an academic teaching finance at Princeton University, but I started my career on Wall Street, so I have been interested in markets for a considerable amount of time, and I started off as a market professional and serve on a number of investment company boards today. So I kind of look at this thing both as a scholar of markets and as a practitioner. And basically, my view, which I believe in even more strongly today than when I first enunciated the view, is that most investors are going to be better off if the core of their portfolio is invested in a low-cost index fund. And by an index fund, I mean simply a fund that buys and holds all the stocks in the market. And it could be a mutual index fund, or it could be an exchange-traded fund. Exchange-traded funds are generally index funds. They're very low expense, and the work that I've done suggests that this is not a mediocre performance that you get from an index fund, but that the index funds generally do better than three-quarters or more of the so-called actively managed funds. Last year, it was the index funds did better than 80%. The first 6 months of this year, the index funds did better than 80%. So it's not average performance you get. It's above average performance. And this ought to be the core of every portfolio. And then if you, you know, you want to buy a few individual stocks, fine. Investing is fun. But you can do it with much less risk if the core of your portfolio, your serious retirement money, is invested in low-cost index funds. So that's basically been my thesis. And I think the evidence over the years suggests that it's exactly the right thing to do.
Bert, this is David Williams. How are you doing today?
Doing just fine, David.
Good. Along with that, and by the way, I would agree with you that most investors will do better by simply buying the index, and that most investors are served by that as a matter of fact, not as a matter even of your opinion or conjecture, that the index funds generally do better than the people actively managing. But additionally, in your book, at least in the original book, and this was some of the questions that I had for you, in your original book, you took a very purist form of your view towards the nature of the market, that in fact it was random completely by nature, and went as far as to say things such as, you know, the market has no memory, that, you know, the current price bar has absolutely no connection or any relationship to the previous price bar, etc. And so this whole radio program and everyone who's listening to it, these are people who are trading in the market on various different kinds of levels. Some of them are day traders, some of them are long-term traders, etc. But obviously, and you know all this, our work is based upon a technical approach to the market, which your original book anyway. I read your original book many, many years ago. I've not read each of the succeeding ones. But my question, I think, would be, have you found yourself, and this is not a gotcha or anything like that, because nobody has any bad intent here. Have you found yourself at all over the years perhaps shifting at all in your original and maybe there's a better way to ask the question, but do you still believe in the purest sense that the market has no memory at all, and or that the current price bar has absolutely no connection in any way, shape, or form to the previous, that sort of thing? Or have you found yourself in some way shifting to, there's something we can do with this information that I might not have considered, you know, in the past, or anything like that, because it's not a gotcha question.
No, it's a very fair question, and this is a book that's actually the 10th edition paperback of it. Was just,
yeah, and congratulations,
published.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
In January of this year, so it's something that I've continued to look at and continued to question, and I don't mind your asking the question. I think it's exactly right. So would I be quite as pure today? And I guess my answer would be not quite as pure, but I haven't changed my general opinion. Now, here's what we do know. When I say I'm not quite as pure, we do know that there is a bit of momentum in the stock market. If you actually look at this statistically, you find that relatively strong stocks often continue to be relatively strong. And relatively weak stocks continue to be relatively weak. So statistically,
And that's a bit of non-randomness. And incidentally, when I say random, I really mean unpredictable. So there's a bit of momentum in the market, but here's where I continue to hold to my view. There's very little of it. In other words, there's some of it which suggests that a technical strategy based on relative strength by the strong stocks, isn't the dumbest thing in the world. But what I do believe is that after transactions costs, the market's pretty close to being unpredictable.
Right. Okay, and fair enough. The reason I'm asking and the reason we're all interested is because, again, we trade in these types of technical ways. And some of these methods, I'm sure you obviously would know many, many of these methods. However, I do want to tell you that I'm not so sure, this is from my opinion, I'm not so sure that the market is as unpredictable, perhaps, as your original position might have suggested. And I'm including your current comment about the momentum, et cetera. And I don't discount the fact that randomness could include trends. Just because a market's trending doesn't mean it's not randomly trending, unless you dispute that. I think a market could be randomly trending in a direction, could it not?
Well, look, again, there's no, I don't know what this gets into semantics as to whether a trend is random or not. As I say, my sense of randomness is predictability, and what worries me is that it's not predictable enough that for the average investor, it's worth the it's worth taking advantage of. You know, there's a joke that we academics tell that I think gets to the idea of, whether markets are efficient or, whether there are ways of really making excess profits. And the argument is that the efficient market guy like myself is walking along with a graduate student and a $100 bill is spotted by the graduate student on the ground. The graduate student stoops to pick it up, and the efficient market guy like myself says, don't bother to stoop to pick it up. If it was really a $100 bill, it wouldn't be there. Now, I'm not that extreme. What I tell my graduate students is pick it up right away because it's not going to be there for long. In other words, if there is, if there is some technical way of saying that if we simply buy stocks with relative strength, we're going to outperform the market, and that is a dependable, predictable factor in the market, then a lot of people are going to operate in a way to destroy it. In other words, for example, suppose there's a Santa Claus rally, and we know that the market rises between Christmas and New Year's. Well, if I know that, I'm going to buy the day before Christmas, the last trading day before the Christmas holiday. So then the market goes up the day before Christmas, and I got to go and I got to anticipate
and
it.
We're arbitraging that benefit away.
Yeah, and I think that this is what I do know about markets, and I know this both as an academic and both as a practitioner, that if there is something that works, I'm suspicious that it's going to continue to work. That's basically my view.
Okay. I have something I'd like you to consider. And you may have thought of this or heard of it in the past, but my company, PageTrader, has developed a methodology that doesn't view the market singularly in one dimension, such as simply looking at prices as a statistician might look at the market, and he may say, I'm just going to take a look at this stream of data, these prices going up and down, and I'm going to come to conclusions about that based upon what this data is doing. And this is what many academics have done in the past, is they look at the market in what I would call a one-dimensional perspective, which is that they're simply looking at the movement of prices. But our perspective is that the market is actually like anything else, like you and I, like a table, like a chair. It exists in three dimensions. It's not one-dimensional. It actually has three full dimensions. And those dimensions, I'd like to tell you what they are, and I'll tell you in a moment, but those three dimensions have an interconnectedness, and that they have a relationship to each other, just as the room that you're in has a relationship from length, width, and depth. That relationship can change and does change, but there is a relationship. And so we've developed a method that considers the market, treats the market as a three-dimensional structure. And in doing so, we've been able to make unusual kinds of forecasts for highly specific movement in the future. And that movement, it's not mystical. The movement is based upon an understanding that we have obtained through studying the market in these perspectives in a three-dimensional way. That movement can be predicted not only in terms of price movement itself to a specific point, but also the time that price should be reached. Now, I've demonstrated that hundreds of times on this radio program over the last 7 years. Two of the most extreme examples would be back last year in the euro, in the early month of August 2011, the three-dimensionality of the euro market suggested that the euro market would top on the week of August 22nd. We made this forecast on the program. And then it would decline $10,000 per contract down. So if you go back and take a look at the euro in the month of August 22nd, or the week of August 22nd, it topped out and then reversed and did indeed go down $10,000 per contract and more. In the month of April of this year, when crude oil prices were trading at $103, early April, we forecast that in May, the crude oil market would crash and needed to touch the price of $88 in the month of May. Even though at the time it was trading at $103 to $106, that the three-dimensionality of the market, something that most academics don't consider the other sides of the market needed to touch $88. And if you go take a look at crude, you'll see that in the month of May, crude indeed touched $88 and lower, just as we forecast. I don't believe that we could do that repeatedly, as we have on the program, if price movement was completely random. And so I'm suggesting that one of the things that may have been overlooked by academics is that the market, like everything else, has three full dimensions to it. And I'll say what they are. Maybe this is something you can consider. First of all, obviously, there's price. But price is not a dimension. Price has to move. In order for prices to go from $1 to $100, they have to move through a form of mathematical space. So there is space there. So space is the dimension. Price is an attribute. It moves through space. So let's call, for lack of a better word, let's just say space or price is the dimension. So we have price. And then, of course, we have time. Time is constantly moving, and the market is moving through time. Time is its own dimension. And then finally, we have volume, which is the depth of participation in the market. So we have these three separate dimensions. And what we have found, and the reason we've been able to make these kinds of public forecasts repeatedly, time and time again, I could go into many more, but these are two big ones that we made recently. The crude oil one was worth $12,000 per contract, and outs a very, very large move that wouldn't have been expected, and I don't think any analysts that we know of made the call for that. The reason we've been able to do this is because we found that there is a connection between the three dimensions, and that when those three get into certain positions, one of those dimensions has to correct for the total position of the three-dimensionality. And we can forecast what that correction will be. So there is a nature in our work to the market. But if you view the market only singularly one-dimensionally as a stream of data in price going up and down, you would miss that connectivity. And I'm suggesting that many that have studied the market have missed that connectivity and therefore that predictability that allows for, under certain conditions, these types of forecasts to be made. Now, I don't expect
to... I'm not going to tell you that either I or any other academic has tested every possible
viewpoint
method to predict prices, whether they're of currencies, whether they're of commodities, or the like. And I'm not going to tell you that it's absolutely impossible, but I would say that what I would recommend for investors is you want to try to profit from these sorts of predictions, fine, go do it. And you can do it with much less risk if you have your serious money invested
right.
in a broad-based index fund. So then you can do these kinds of things. And I even buy, you know, individual stocks myself. You know, I'm not going to tell you that it's absolutely impossible. But look, what I do know is most of the people who do this sort of thing get a performance that is not as good.
And that's true.
As a typical index fund. And if you can do it, God bless you. That's wonderful. I hope you, you know, I hope you keep it up. And if you can do it consistently, you ought to be able to retire at a very early age with a lot of marbles.
Well, I'm 55 years old, so early is getting out of the realm for me right now.
Okay, well,
how old are you,
keep it up. I'm 79. And,
are you really? Oh, my goodness. Yep. I didn't realize you were 79. Well, then I'm young compared to you now, aren't I?
Yeah, yeah. But I'm still still very active. And,
no, you are.
And this is something that I think is another thing I would recommend that the people who are active and actively engaged and interested in these things have a much better, richer, and fuller life.
Ah, well said. And listen, I want to also say something that one of the things that you really press the point on, and I think some of the people who follow or who might detract or attempt to detract from your work would be that you're talking about the average investor. The average investor is going to do better. Obviously, the statics can't be questioned. He's going to do better following or buying the index fund as his core holdings because he's not going to outpick the market as a general rule. And I think that that's absolutely the truth. I don't think there's any question about that at all. And I would say that whether you're on the program or not, and because you make a very clear point, you say, I think the average investor. I think in time, over time, Burton, I think we're going to find that there are other truths, principles about the markets that will be discovered, like everything else in science, things that seem impossible at a certain age and a certain period of time later get broken through, and that may well occur with the markets as well. As strange a creature as they are, we may find something at some point, and there certainly have been many, many attempts, and the truth of what you've written in your books has stood the test of time, as you just described it, that the average investor is indeed going to do better with the index fund than he is. And the other point, that by paying out the money to not advisors, but whatever, you know, the people that manage those funds, that those expenses add up very, very quickly and very quickly chew up any of the gains that they
Well, I think that that's particularly true. You know, one of the things that I like to say is that all of us who have worked in the markets for years
really need to be very modest about what we know and don't know, which is one of the reasons why I'm not going to tell you that the ideas that you have can't work, and where, you know, I think you presumably need to be modest about how consistent this is, and are you never going to make wrong calls. Having said that, I want to tell you the one thing and the only thing about investing that I am absolutely 100% sure of, and that is that the lower the expense that I pay to the purveyor of the investment service, the more there will be for me.
No doubt.
The beauty of the index funds and ETFs is the expense ratios now are really pretty close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they really are. They have come way down over time.
They've come way down, and that's the nice thing about capitalism and the nice thing about competition.
Well, I just hope we continue to have capitalism in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, we can certainly 100% agree on that.
Okay. I don't think I need to add anything to that. Well, it's been wonderful to have you on. It's a delight for me to talk to you because I read your book many, many years ago, and I just want to say that it's delightful to speak with you.
Well, it's been my pleasure talking with you, and I'm delighted to be on the program. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Burton, we really do appreciate you taking time to come and be with us today. Someone in the audience had asked a question. Why would Burton buy individual stocks if they are, in fact, unpredictable? But I think that you answered that well, in that while your core investment portfolio is in something like an index fund, you like to have a little fun with individual stocks. And one of the big stocks in the news today and for the last few weeks is Facebook. And we're not asking for any investment advice, but do you have any thoughts on that stock and what's happened with it and where it might be heading?
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. But you actually put it exactly right. The reason I buy some individual stocks is that it is fun. It's fun to invest. I would still be somewhat worried about Facebook, because I don't know yet for sure how they're going to make money. I mean, obviously they've got a lot of users. This is a major phenomenon. It's a stock that has been an amazing success in terms of getting users. What it's just not clear to me yet,
right,
is how they're going to monetize the base of subscribers that they have, and whether $60 billion market capitalization is the right capitalization. At some point, I think Facebook may be a very good buy, but I think it still is very expensive relative to what I think can be foreseen in terms of their ability to monetize the subscriber base that they have. They may well be able to do it, but it's been an amazing success. It hasn't been a success for people who bought the stock at the IPO, and in general, people who buy stocks at the IPO don't do particularly well. And I think one, it's certainly very, very speculative, but at some point it may be fine. My own sense is I'm not itching to go and buy it at 20. It wouldn't surprise me to see this in the teens pretty soon.
Well, you know, we have today is the first day coming out of the lockup phase for some of the shares, and I believe it's 240 million shares being released into the market today as free trading. And over the next 4 months, there will be a total of 2 billion, B as in boy, 2 billion shares coming into the market. We're already trading at half the IPO price, IPO at 38, and today we traded down to 19 and change. Facebook did have some recent news that they are test piloting, if you will, in Britain, online gambling. And as we know, casinos, because they do base how they run their shop on statistics, you know, the blackjack dealer, the house rules, all of that designed to operate in the favor of the house. So if Facebook can get their hand into this business of gambling, and if it's widely accepted, not that I'm not taking any kind of a pro-gambling stance, but beyond that, how they will monetize their user base, I don't know. I mean, we have Apple and Google both trading at closer to 15 times earnings, and Facebook IPO'd at over 100 times anticipated earnings, and now that's been cut in half. And I agree with you, lower teens probably, and I don't know. I mean, 2 billion shares is an awful lot, and how well the market can absorb those, and that's all going to come to market in the next 4 months. Today is just the beginning of that.
Yeah, could be. It's certainly dangerous, but you know, at some point, unlike in the dot-com boom, where you had companies that weren't real, at least this is a real company.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is, with some very smart people working there.
And absolutely.
And they have a product that people love, perhaps a little too much. Some people spend a little too much time on the Facebook each and every day. But that ultimately is how they will maximize shareholder value. I know you need to run, but one of the quotes that I spotted in your book that you were quoting Sir Isaac Newton when you said, "I can calculate the motions of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people."
Absolutely, and this is why we have speculative bubbles in the United States, and why we are likely to continue to have them over time, and whether they're dot-com companies, whether they're condominiums in Las Vegas, it's human nature, I think, and we are very likely to continue to have this, and that's where you really can lose money, is when you've got something that is in a very popular, is in a bubble. This is the thing to be really careful about.
Burton, one other thing I noticed that recently you have, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, about the housing market, that you believe the housing market is essentially bottomed, you know, quote unquote, or maybe you didn't put it in those terms, but you believe the housing market is...
I think housing is more affordable today than it has ever been, and if someone can qualify for a mortgage, and I'm well aware that... the banks in 2006 and 2007 were giving loans with nothing down. It's much tougher to get a loan now, but if you can get a loan now, housing is more affordable than ever, and I would certainly recommend to your listeners that if you're thinking of buying a house, this is a great time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, couldn't be in agreement with you more on that, and we've talked about that on the program for many months here. We feel the same way.
Good enough.
Yeah. Really quick.
All right, okay.
Really quick.
It's been delightful to talk to you guys, and I really, really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you, Bert.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
really
Thank
nice.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Bye bye now.
There you are.
There it is. I wanted to ask him about gold in China, but he had to go. So, there he was, Mr. Burton McKill, right here on CFRN, the Christian Financial Radio Network. We pulled it off.
Oh.
It's all right. Let's go.
Well, there you are. So, obviously, this is a very nice guy. You know, he's not somebody that's holding himself in high esteem. I liked several of the things that he said. You know, he's not holding his original position with quite the purity. And I didn't know that for a fact, but I got the sense from things that had been said by him and others about his work subsequent to, you know, the original book that gave me the idea that he may have softened. I wasn't sure, but I think he did a service to the technicians and to the people who are efficient market people, both by, you know, with the modesty that he displayed, saying we don't know for sure. It's, you know, one thing he does know for sure, and we have to agree with him, is that the average investor is going to do better holding index funds than they are picking stocks. I don't think there's any question about that. And that actually is his core position, which is then, you know, rotating around that, but further out is the mathematical side, where he took positions about the purity of, you know, the random nature of the market and things like that. So that was very good. It was very good for me to hear that, and very good for me to hear him, you know, speak from where he is. This is a man that's 79 years old. He's lived a lot of life. He's seen a lot. You know, he's a professor, been through a lot, is active in markets. He's not just a pure academic. And so I found that delightful, actually.
Yeah, I enjoyed what he had to say about the $100 bill.
that's funny. There's funny, that story. It's almost like the, in many ways, some classic stories, just like in, you know, a million years ago, there were many, many versions of Adam and Eve. I don't know if you know that, but the story of Adam and Eve is not a singular story that's in the Bible. There were many, many versions of an Adam and Eve around at that time. And this goes on and on and on throughout history. There's many versions of the two people walking and they see something on the road type of story. And so that's the container for, you know, that particular subject matter that he picked it up. And he says, well, if it looks like, you know, if there's a $100 bill there, you better get it because it's actually not there, because they don't believe, you know, in the purest sense that there's ever any inefficiencies in the market. So I've heard that same story applied to other professions and other disciplines. So,
well, his take on it was that most people would say, don't bother picking it up, because most of his contemporaries would say, don't bother bending down to pick it up because it's not really there. And he said, whereas I would say, pick it up quick before it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we did it. All right, what else you want to talk about today?
Well, we could talk about the markets a little bit. We can take a look around and see what the market's showing us here. We've already talked a little about the S&P, and it's moving higher, and we talked about earlier where we think it's going, et cetera. So let's let them – they just closed the hour out just a few moments ago. So they're attempting – right now we're continuing to attempt higher prices. We'll continue to watch that as we go on here. If you want, we can switch over to. Do you have anything you want to add, by the way, Duane? To
the next spot overhead that we're watching would be 1410, 1411, and back earlier in the week. Let's see, on Tuesday it was right here. We came within two ticks of that weekly trading zone. And now it looks like the market, despite any drag that Facebook might have on it, and actually it doesn't. European markets are doing fine. The French CAC's up 31. Germany's up 49. The S&P's up 5. So the fact that Facebook is down is not having a, you know, any big effect on the markets overall. And it looks like this little price, this little candle here, wants to go wee all the way up to 1400. Did you have anything in that area or anything above that?
One moment. The 1400 area in which market, Dwayne? I'm sorry.
On the S&P, I was saying the next area that we have overhead is 1410.
Oh, well, there's a little short term stuff, but broadly speaking, we would expect any confirmed breakout above 1402 to run ultimately to 1416 or higher. So, you know, we do have on our support and resistance panel for today, which is, this is a little bit of a different subject, but it's closer by stuff. We have 1409, 1410, 1413. And again, remember, these numbers are close together because volatility has been very small.
Right.
And then the 1416, 1417, and higher. So these are the levels. But the 1416 is more important to us, and we like the idea that if they break out, that, you know, higher prices would be indicated here. So, and I agree, yeah, Facebook isn't having much of an effect at this point here on today's session. There's plenty else that's headed higher here. So we think higher prices, I like the idea of buying it, and, you know, understanding, if I just may say this, that we want to see, if possible, we want to see daily closes above $1,401, 1402 area, which we've had every single day, you know, since the market has gotten, you know, basically since August 10th, Friday. So we've had 4 days of that, and they're attempting higher. So we like the bullish side of this. We've talked about this a number of times, Dwayne, that the market's done nothing that isn't bullish. Everything it's done has been bullish. Actually, starting from back August 2nd, when they had sold off from the July 30th top, that sell-off was very contained, didn't interrupt the uptrend at all, and of course we had a good rally out of that. That helped the picture, and now I think we're going to see substantially higher coming here. So it is real quiet. You're going to have to wait. You're going to have the patience to hold on to the market. One of the things about the efficient market theory that I would have liked to have talked about a little bit, but and it's fair that he doesn't want to get into that in a discussion of the nature that we had today, but that the element of time is not really taken into account. The efficient market theory simply suggests that prices of commodities and securities already contain all the known information. There's some assumptions in all this. I'll say what it is. They already contain all the known information, so there's nothing to buy or sell because every known or even unknown, remember he mentioned the weak, the medium, and the strong. Well, the strong of that theory is that, you know, everything known and unknown is already in the price. So there's nothing for you to buy and have the market correct to, that which would be the assumption that we're talking about, that if everything's known, then prices have all the information they could possibly have. There's nothing you can do or know that would bring you a profit. The market is too efficient in pricing itself at all the known, with all the known information in there. But that's just one way to view the market. The efficient price market model may very well be true, that the markets are, you know, if not in purity, 100% efficient, they are gosh darn efficient. Let's just put it that way. They're pretty darn efficient. When information gets known, people rush in. It's very much like traffic. You know, a little opening in traffic opens up, and you think, well, I'd like to get my car in there, and before you know it, somebody else's car is already in there. That's because traffic is somewhat efficient, that gaps in traffic are filled in by people, et cetera. We've all seen that. Well, markets are similar in that way. But that efficient market thesis, true as it may be, does not address the entire subject. So to say that if markets are efficient, therefore there's no other advantages, that's where I think the error is. I think there are other advantages, and I think that the efficiency of markets doesn't need to be addressed by these other techniques. And so it's a little complicated to go into, but in a way, they're pinning all of, not him, but people who are completely immersed in the efficient market theory are hanging their entire hat on that one fact, that markets indeed are pretty efficient. They're not totally efficient. There's always going to be accidents and little openings and things, and there is room. You know, that's what the whole business of arbitrage is all about, because those arbitragers are buying and selling those efficiencies away. And as the markets got more efficient through the electronic markets, that indeed picked up the efficiency of markets, because now we've gotten closer to you being able to think something, get some information, and act on it instantaneously without having to go through a floor broker, a person who has to get your information and say, oh, you want to buy? Okay, let me turn around and, hey, I've got five I'd like to sell over here. Well, that gap left inefficiency in the market. Now that we have electronic trading, the market is actually, I would argue, more efficient. That the moment people get information and are able to express their response to that information, that picked up the efficiency. But even in a 100% absolutely pure, efficient market, it wouldn't make any difference to a separate way. In my particular case, in spatial relationship forecasting, the market could be 100% efficient. The kind of move we're calling for is so completely out of line with those efficiencies. It's a whole different thing. It's almost like you're asking, you know, our big thing, well, you're asking the wrong question. You're not going to get the right answer asking the wrong question. The right question is, are markets efficient? And the answer is, for the most part, they are. And they've gotten more efficient with the Globex and with the, not the Globex, but with the electronic trading. But does an efficient market mean that you cannot forecast prices based on some other principle? And the answer is no, because the markets are even more efficient now than they used to be, and the markets are still running to forecastable prices based on a different principle than mere efficiency. The efficiency is there, but that isn't the real question. There's other issues in the market. There's other principles at work in the market other than efficiency. And I don't think there's any good argument that could state that the markets aren't now even more efficient because of electronic trading.
Well, if you go to, you're familiar with the, I don't know if you are or not, the TED Talks. Are you familiar with those?
With the, I'm sorry, say it again.
It's called TED, T-E-D Talks.
No.
Where,
I mean, there's a TED strategy that I know of, but that has to do with T-bills and stuff like that.
No, I don't think you're referring to that. This has to do with conferences that are given out in Silicon Valley. Let me just... Hang on a second. TED Talks. It's really quite popular, and some of the most... Can you see my screen, David?
Sure.
TED Ideas Worth Spreading. Mm-hmm. It may be that you just haven't been exposed to that yet. There's a ton of... These people give these talks about all kinds of controversial and thought-provoking things. And some of them are incredibly boring, but some of them are incredibly fascinating. And there's TED, and then there's also... TEDx, for those who can see that little X back there. And I bring it up because I watched one the other day because I was following a rabbit trail. I'd read an article that had a link, and then I clicked and read that link, and it took me to a video on TED about the increase in high-frequency trading. They show the amount of time that it, in this little video, the amount of time that it takes the human brain to process a thought about, if you're looking at a chessboard with two chess pieces, and is my king in danger? And I'm not even a chess guy, but I kind of understand the concept. And so they put all these people through this MRI, and they were showing, they were on the top of the MRI, they had a screen up there where people could see this chessboard, and they were trying to measure the amount of time that it took the human brain to process the thought or the question, is my king in danger? Are you with me?
Sure.
And they were able to, you know, with it wasn't nanoseconds, but it was whatever 1,000th of whatever time it was, they were able to document this. And then the guy takes you into a server room where there's just rack after rack after rack after rack of what they call co-located servers,
uh-huh,
right next door to the exchange. And if Bert is on with us, our Bert, he might be able to speak of this. He might know some of these people that work in these firms. But algorithms are trading. Humans are not involved. Computers are trading against computers. And the fact that they will pay money for a faster machine and that they will put it closer to the exchange, because
right,
the speed of light, you know, to send something at the speed of light across the transatlantic channel, you know, across that cable,
uh-huh,
it takes the speed of light longer to get from here to London than it does from one building to the building next door where the trades
right
are being executed. And this was just a very thought-provoking, and I've heard, you know, a lot of different discussions. I read a lot of different articles about algorithms and the high frequency trading, and that's, you know, over 70% of trades today are done by computers with no humans involved, and blah blah, and that was part of the issue with Knight Securities a couple weeks ago, although Knight now says that really wasn't the core issue.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, and I'm only bringing it up today, and I encourage people to go watch some of those videos and, you know, arrive at your own opinion. But the market, as more and more of these computers continue to trade against each other, that efficiency that you're speaking of,
mm-hmm,
can only grow.
That's correct.
Now, he did point out in his video that when they had a man play a computer. How did this turn out when some chess big guy traded against an IBM computer, Big Blue?
Yeah, the Ice Blue or whatever the computer was.
Now,
it was Boris something.
Yeah. Who won? Did the computer win or did
the computer
guy win?
The computer won.
Okay, that's what I thought. I just want to make sure I was remembering how he told the story correctly. And they then went on to show that the computer would always beat the man. But if you gave the man a computer, the man working together with the computer would always beat the computer.
That's interesting.
After time, after time, mm-hmm, after time. Because man was capable of doing, while the computer could do things the man couldn't do, the man could also do things that the computer couldn't do.
Right. So those efficiencies that man has were being played out. One of the things that the computer can do in chess, the computer can think more levels ahead than pretty much anybody can think. In order to think a level ahead, the chessboard has the 8 pieces in front of you, and you know each player has 16 pieces, I think. And so they all get placed on the board in different ways. Well, to think a move or two ahead is not too difficult. To think 3 moves ahead is doable. But when you get to 7, 8, 10, and 12, and 15 moves ahead, the entire board would have to be retained in your mind, and you'd have to have a very, very astounding, like, photographic memory in order to keep the picture of how many steps ahead you were and what the board would look like so that you could make the best decision now based on all these possible things. Well, the computer can go 25, 30, 40, 50 moves ahead if it wants to, if it feels it's necessary. Human really can't do that. But that isn't the only efficiency that's there. It's kind of like the point you're making, and I think you're making it because of this, is that the computer was able to do this one thing and be very efficient in this one way, But there's more than one way to skin a cat, and that's why that saying has stood the test of time. Because the efficiency of the market, the battle for the final bits of inefficiency is on. The battle is being fought with computers. That's essentially what is could be said is going on. That battle isn't the only way to win from the market. These people have dove in these quant funds where they use computers, trading with computers, and they locate their offices extremely close and on, fastest computers on the planet, et cetera. They're trading in nanoseconds. They have the, you know, pennies per trade cost and all that stuff. And they're going to fight that battle down to the nth degree. It's going to get subatomic at some point. I mean,
hey, Dave, but I've that's got not someone knocking at yes. my door. Can you take the discussion for a moment
sure, I'll be right back. Yeah,
no,
go ahead. So isn't it interesting, though, that that is where the battle is? The battle is in picking up the last remaining efficiencies of the market and doing so faster and faster against more and more players who have better and better computers until finally what happens? What is the end game of that? Is all, you know, if the markets really were too efficient to make money back when Burton wrote his book in 1973, clearly they're more efficient now. You know, they're way more efficient because whatever inefficiencies were there have all been gobbled up since then with the advent of computers. And then certainly in 1995, 1996, when Globex, whenever Globex, you know, came on, that increased, not Globex specifically, but the computerized trading of E-mini futures, that completely took a huge chunk of efficiency or inefficiency out of the market. And it goes on and on. And so now we're down to the atomic level where these people are fighting over, and many of them do very well. The trader that we have on from time to time, our good friend Michael, we always say his last name is X because we don't put his name out there, but he is very closely, and I actually, when he came out to Las Vegas last year, and I've related this story, but he came out with some friends of his who actually work at a quant fund, and they're deep in it. Some of these guys are the computer people and some other people, and they're right in the middle of the whole game of chewing up the remaining efficiency in the market. So let them battle over that efficiency. Let them have that battle. That's only one side of the market. That battle, I think, incorrectly has been characterized as the only battle. When the efficiency is gone, you might as well go get a job because there's nothing left in the market. That's the conclusion that I believe is incorrect. The conclusion that efficiency was the only way for you to get your dollar out of the market, that efficiency was the block to any real gains in the market. Efficiency is one of the many characteristics of the market, and it's not a block to the market except if you are in the battle of picking up money through efficiency, which these guys are. There's other ways to get the money out of the market other than relying on the battle of efficiency. They assumed, I believe, wrongly, that efficiency was the battle and the only battle. And I'm absolutely 100% certain that is not the case. The markets are difficult to trade, even no matter whose technique you're using. And I can speak of my own and with regard to spatial relationship and all that. It still is work to make money. But the philosophy or conclusion that efficiency was the only battle in the market, I'm 100% certain is wrong. It is a battle in the market, and they're battling over it now, but it's not the only one. And that there's other ways, that's why I say, that saying, there's other ways to skin a cat, there's more than one way to skin a cat, it's kind of ugly if you're a PETA person, because who wants to skin a cat? They're friendly little creatures, you feed them. You don't skin them, but
well,
it's the same.
When you made that comment, you know, that phrase has stood the test of time.
Yes.
So have the cats.
Yeah, and look at that. They're still here. That's why I wonder about evolution a lot. If we evolved from the apes, why do we still have apes?
We got more cats roaming around now in the back alleys than ever. And yeah. People just keep coming up with new ways to skin them.
Huh. Yeah. I just want to say about cats, I've never really been a cat person, even in the least. But while my mother was alive, she lived at a house, and I was there, and I saw a mother cat with 9 little babies, and she was trying to feed those babies. And it just touched me, and I thought, oh, gosh, these poor things. Wouldn't it be nice if I just put some food out for them? I mean, that's the least I can do. So I went to the store and bought some food, and I put the food out, and the mother cat was very protective, and, you know, she had her 9 cats. And the mother didn't look that good. I mean, you know, it beats you up to have that many offspring. Anyway, they slowly started to trust enough to come over and start eating, and then I started feeding them regularly. And over time, I got a little bit better feel for what cats are doing and how they interact with you and what their thing is, because they seem very different, obviously, very, very different than dogs. They have a different nature. And over time, one cat in particular, only one, these were feral cats. These are outdoor cats. One of them would let me touch his back, and his back would curve up. He was so sensitive to that, but he would let me touch his back. And then once in a while, he would wander off from the group and just come over and visit me in the backyard. And I just thought, oh, isn't that sweet? How can, you know, come on. That's adorable. And this cat was trusting enough that it would come over and sit with me and all that. So I have a cat, and this was years and years ago. This cat has to be now 8 years old. And over time, I've learned a whole lot more about the nature of women through this cat. I just want to say, if you want to understand women better, go get a cat. You'll figure it out real, real pretty like. Anyway, it's been a lot of fun. And I don't particularly like, you know, quote unquote, cat people. You know, they're a little nutty, but I do have a cat, and I have learned a lot about how they think and act and what they like and what they don't like, and their irritabilities and all that stuff, but they're definitely domestic animals, and they do show their affection in their own way. So I've learned something from that.
Well, people who have one cat usually aren't bad. It's the people who have 50.
16, yeah. 16 cats and all that stuff. You just stay away from those people. That's proof that the disorder has grown to biblical proportions, and, you know, it's not going to end well. And then you have the people that we see on TV programs, who get the big animals, the tigers and the lions and the, you know, the dangerous animals, and they want to get close to them. They want to feel they have a special connection with them, that something wild in nature has selected them to be nice to, even though they know they could kill them. And in many cases, they do kill them. My next door neighbor in my original office, for Page Trader, I told you this story, and I'll just briefly recant it here, that one day he came over to my office with 2 what looked like little cats, and he said, would you mind letting my cats play in your office here, because the Board of Health is coming over. He had a tattoo shop, and he didn't want the cats in there. So I did, and I thought, they're kind of unusual-looking cats, but maybe they're just a certain breed. Well, it turns out they were tigers. They were baby tigers. And, you know, you'd walk by and they'd be hiding in a little dark spot, and they would come flinging out and grab your leg and, you know, bite into it. It didn't hurt at all, but they were, you know, practicing for killing you later. So that's what they were doing. And later, about 8-10 months later, I saw those same cats in the back of his truck in a large cage. They were fully grown, like huge, or however long ago it was later. They were huge. I wouldn't even get close to them. And he was one of these people who later decided to not keep animals at his house because it's just too dangerous. They're really not domesticatable. One thing I will say is that he did have a pig at his house, which was one of the most adorable things I've ever seen in my life. If you've ever had a chance to sit down with a sort of, I don't know which kind of pig it is, a domestic, pot-bellied, or I don't know what it is.
Pot-bellied pigs, I think that's what they
people have for their pets. This thing was better than a dog. I mean, not better, but it was like a dog in many ways. It wagged its tail. It smacked its lips. You could see happiness in its eyes. It came over and snuggled with you. It liked to play. It's the funniest little thing. Strange, weird, rough skin. I mean, it's nothing like a dog in that way, but I just had a wonderful time with this little pig who would just all he wanted to do was play. And if you gave him something to eat, they smack their lips in a way that is, it'll just, I can't even describe it. It's very, very funny. They're just wonderful little creatures. I don't have one of those either, but just letting you know. Anyway, so the battle is on. You know,
name
we're talking
the world,
about the efficiency.
Name TV's most famous pig.
I don't know, but there's something back there
Arnold.
In my memory. Who?
Arnold.
Arnold the pig from
Green Acres.
Green Acres. Green Acres
be.
Is a place for me.
First one in the audience to get it was Bruce. Way to go, Bruce.
Wow.
Charles
he's fast.
Second, yep.
Okay, so we can move on. S&P is
pig.
Now testing.
I mean, he could hold his own with Lassie, that pig.
He could.
All right.
What's the most famous dolphin?
Flipper, come on.
Flipper. Yeah. But what about Orca?
I don't know Orca.
Well, Orca was the later one that, you know. I agree with you. Flipper was it. That's for people like you and I that are old. While we've been talking, the inefficiency of the market has led it up to 1410. They're
mm-hmm.
testing that level now.
Yeah.
Dwayne has this level. This is a level that we mentioned earlier as well that is important. However, I think higher prices are coming, but this is certainly a place to trade to. We attempted to get long earlier in Messenger Pro for the run to 2000, for the run to 1410. We weren't able to get long. The market just moved up and continues to. So we have a very good day going in the S&P. Quiet, persistent, sort of a trend day up underway. So we'll take a quick look around here. And let's see.
Well, Bruce, the most famous frog I would have to say was Kermit. I'm trying to think if there's any other. The most famous tuna would be Charlie.
Charlie.
Okay, guys, here's a daily chart of the ES. And the other night we did a blog post about how to not make a living spotting, you know, market tops because they only come along so often. But how that you might begin to notice one. And what we see happening right here on this daily chart, this is a Globex session, is we're seeing this top. If we close way up here, we're starting to see this top, this pattern, get negated. Now you can see that this upslope has been on declining volume. However much stock you put in that is entirely up to you. But if we close up above this high here, that changes the whole nature of this pattern. Doesn't mean it couldn't go on to later do it in some grander fashion. But for now, for today, if this thing is holding, what we should see is a lower close, and then a break of this trend line. So we still have one more weekly zone overhead. And it's higher than the number you talked. You talked about 1416, David.
Just as a tradable target, yeah.
Yeah, our highest number for the week's 1425.26. So
okay.
Still way up there. And there's one mm-hmm. more trading day, so we'll see what happens. We'll see how it closes today. This thing ran up pretty quickly here in the last 2 hours, right? Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Not even two full hours, hour and a half. We covered, well, that's only a 5-point range or 6.
Yeah, it's
range.
Quiet. It's not, I mean, for recent behavior, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, it is.
For recent
yeah.
behavior, it's pretty good.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so move on. Yeah, let's take a look on. I do want to say something about Burton. I don't think he's listening or anything, but I do want to say that I listen just as much, and I hope others do as well. I listen just as much to how people say things. As much as what they're saying. In fact, I think, honestly, in my particular case, I think I listen more to how people say things than actually what they're saying. And sometimes that has caused me some problems because somebody might say something in a way that rubs me the wrong way, but they may be giving out perfectly true and accurate information. That's happened many, many times. Of course, it could happen. I think I lean more on listening to how people say things than I do the content of what they're saying. So many of the academics that are in my background are very self-filled what's the word, you know, holier than thou, you know, snub your nose, you know, whatever all those phrases are, that kind of thing. Because, and even my stepfather, I told a story once about my stepfather who had gone into an art store. I have many good things to say about him, but one of the ugly things about him was that he went into an art store with my mother. She related the story to me, and the man behind the counter was, through some conversation as they were looking at art, my mom had a really strong interest in pre-Columbian art. And so as he was standing, my stepfather was standing and waiting, and the man behind the counter said, well, you know, what do you do? Or some conversation came across, and my stepfather said, well, he, at that time, taught philosophy at Cal State Northridge. And the man got very excited, the owner of the shop, and said, oh, I've always loved philosophy, and many people do. We don't necessarily go to school for it or whatever, but you just love philosophy, the exploration of ideas and this sort of thing. And the man was like that, and he expressed a great deal of enthusiasm, and he wanted to talk to Jerry, my stepfather, a little bit about it. And in a very ugly moment, we all have them in our lives, my stepfather basically said, well, we really couldn't have a discussion because you're not educated enough to have that discussion with me. Something like that.
Wow.
The man was just,
that's,
you know,
painful.
Obviously that's a crushing thing. The man was just enthusiastic, would have taken any left or right turn that my stepfather would have liked to take, would gladly have agreed that he wasn't educated, but he just wanted to go into it a little bit. And so I have a background of seeing that played out many, many times over. And I know we don't know Burton, you know, in person and stuff, but for all intents and purposes, he came across quite genuine to me. Mm-hmm. Over the radio without a lot, I listened a lot to that tone, without a lot of that, and he didn't stretch, and he didn't take any liberties with any of that. So I appreciate that about him, about the manner in which he, you know, talked about his own work, interacted with us on the radio, etc. Believe me, it could be a whole lot worse. Ain't no two gosh darn ways about it, because I was raised in an environment where I saw that kind of ugly academic egotism, mm-hmm. which is disgusting, to be quite blunt. So,
and there's every possibility, I don't know, but this gentleman we spoke to today, Mr. McKeel, that in his younger days, he might have been a little fuller of pee and vinegar, as they say.
Right.
With age comes wisdom and maturity and humility. Not in every case. Some people just get more cantankerous.
Right. But, well, I like the way, the fact that there are many, many people who, once they've written their idea down, whatever it was and whenever it was, they're going to defend it to their death. That's why there's an old saying that, you know, the old guard has to die before new things happen. The old guard doesn't let the new stuff happened. The discoveries have to wait for them to die. Those people protect those ideas and promote them and protect them. It may well be true that perhaps in his younger years he was that way, but he, without any stumble, he was very, I thought, genuine in saying, perhaps I have lightened up a little bit on some of the purity that I had in that original book about the efficient market and so on. And so I appreciate that, because even that is difficult to get out of some of the academics. And part of the reason he may have that certainly is age and wisdom and, life showing him that there's more than, you know, all of us know that there's more than anything that we know. Life is bigger than any of us. And at the same time, he's also not just an academic. He's a guy that actually works with markets. So, if you take a look at what he's really saying, he's just basically saying, listen, the average guy should be in index funds because you're not going to outpick the stock market. I don't have any problem with that. I don't think anybody should. That is not a problem at all. That's absolutely true. I think where people curve off
but
from
it's
him
not nearly
is,
as good a book title.
Yeah, it's not nearly as good a book title, and the book title was very clever, and back then it was enormously clever because those ideas had not been introduced to the public at that time, the idea of a random walk and things like that. These were all part of the mathematical community, the academic community, et cetera, back in 73. And, you know, he wrote the book, probably took him a couple years to write the book. So he was coming up with this stuff in 71 and so on. But I appreciated the genuineness, and I would say that to him, but even without him ever hearing it,
that thing was banged out on the
ugliness. What's that?
That thing was banged out on a Smith Corona.
That was banged out on a Smith Corona. So there
Remember
you go.
Remember when the IBM Selectric came out? That was like a modern technological marvel. The IBM Selectric 3.
Well, we'll be saying the same thing about the iPhone 5 in about 40 years.
Yeah, I guess.
Remember when people used to have to, you know, so that's just the case. Just remember that even the number 2 pencil seemed like a great thing at one point. And, you know, now we have Google, you know, in our city here, we have cars in Las Vegas driving the streets with no driver in them. They're completely computer controlled. They're driving around Las Vegas. They're testing them right out here. So that's coming. You'll be able to do work in your back seat. And, you know, you can just, on certain days, you can just let your car drive you to work. Other days, if you want to drive it, you can drive it. So it's going to be a strange new world. You know, at some point, we're going to be able to look back. And maybe that's what 2012 is all about. You know, we're only a few months away, not from the election, well, certainly from the election, but certainly also from the big Mayan calendar date that people are quite certain, you know, something big and life-changing is going to happen on that date. I think something big and life-changing is going to happen on the next election. That's what I think.
Yep.
All right, so let's move on. Let's take a look at a few of the other markets here. So let's take a look. Okay, so gold, I don't have a lot to add to gold. We're still inside this range that we've been in over the last few days. We had the call for the 1586 bottom. They advanced off that. They tried. We talked about them potentially breaking out. They closed slightly above a level, but it essentially was a head fake, and then they slammed back down to the 91 level. We've talked to Dwayne talked the other day about some very big investors purchasing gold, so that should be interesting to watch as well. We'll see how that plays out over time. And by the way, I don't know what they purchased. I don't know if they purchased the metal. Dwayne, do you know if they purchased the metal or if they purchased ETFs or what did you?
I believe that in the two instances I was quoting yesterday, they both purchased. Which this should make you feel good. They actually purchased. These really smart guys. They purchased ETFs.
Okay. Well, you might want to let them know that those ETFs, they may not cash those out because that piece of paper. No, just kidding.
Which tells you they aren't planning on holding it very long. So, because they're
maybe.
Let's see. George Soros increased his position in the Spider Gold to 137 million. So he had 319,000 shares. He now has 884,000 shares.
Mm-hmm.
Paulson, Paulson purchased 4.5 million shares of the Spider Gold Trust, bringing his entire holding in the Spider Gold Trust to 21.8 million. So
yeah,
Paulson
that's a
now has 21.8 million shares, and Soros only has 884,000. So they're light years apart there.
Mm-hmm.
And
should be interesting.
Interestingly enough, speaking of Soros, I think it was Jack. That was pretty funny, Jack. Most famous whale, Soros. That was pretty good. Remember we're talking about most famous animals?
Right, right.
Jack
that's
had
funny.
Jack had typed in most famous whale, Soros.
Soros, yeah. There you are.
That was pretty funny. Well, I thought it was pretty funny, pretty Jack.
All right, so we'll move on here. We're, you know, obviously our position on gold is that we are bullish. We're still in our longer-term position. The market has contained itself inside a very sizable multi-week range here, and we'll see how it plays out at this point. The fact is that I still believe that at this point, the 1586 low we talked about is still worth treating it as a bottom for the time being. In order to really confirm it at this point, though, we would need a further confirmed breakout, and we have not had that yet on the upside. So we'll talk. If we see any other kind of roadmap or something for this, I'll be very happy to bring it up. The bond market continues to decline. I've urged people too many times on the radio to take advantage of the low interest rates. They're still very low, but the market has declined sharply. I happen to know of an institutional trader, private type of trader, but a guy in some size that had shorted the bond market, and I can see that the market, I hope he held onto his position because they've really cracked the bond market pretty good here on the downside. We've talked about Facebook, the euro. You know, we have our longer-term forecast for the month of July being the 1 month late for a bottom. So I like the idea of long positions, slow summertime movement, but still the market continues to confirm the outlook so far. Crude oil continues to advance. This is going to obviously continue to affect the gasoline prices. We had forecast a top back on August 7th. It came one day late on August 8th, a few ticks higher. We had a multi-day decline. Today is the first day that they've actually really exceeded that top. This would be a reflected wave breakout on the upside, which is a very potentially powerful signal for crude. So keep that in mind. Let's see. Tesla, I don't have a lot to add to Tesla except that we're bullish on it. The market did have a larger than expected decline. We had several weeks ago, we talked about the market, if they closed above $26.60 on the week of July 30th, that you could just buy it. They did close above that, and the market has moved higher by about 4 points, 5 points, something like that, off that bottom. And so this is a company that I mentioned this the other day. They disappointed investors because they're taking their time to make sure that every car that leaves their factory has everything right about it, that there's, you know, they're doing the very highest and possible quality control that they can. And, you know, you can't win with the investor, because the investor wants a fast return on his dollar. He wants them to ship as many cars as they can to bring money in. But if he ships those cars and they didn't have really excellent quality, the investor would be complaining then as well, because income would decline. So, you know, he has to do what he thinks is right for the company, and I think he's right to do that. So let's see, anything else here? We've got the U.S. Treasury market, the euro we talked about. Give me just a moment here. I haven't talked much about silver lately, but I don't have much to say. And then let's move over to the soybean markets. The markets have been relatively quiet here. Soybeans, we remember we had the top that was due on August 13th. It came in one trading day early on Friday, August 10th. This was a Friday-Monday thing. So the 13th was the on-time day. The 10th was the one day early. They had a decent decline off that from 1668 down to 1587, nearly a dollar, inching in on a dollar. And they're still bouncing here. Nothing really to add on that either. We may have something on that tomorrow, though, so we'll talk about it depending on how they act today. And so really, for the most part, you know, we're in the summertime market. I've offered everybody a really good trade: collect all of your change and bring it to the bank and then put it in the machine, and then it'll give you money out. You know, I was with some friends. this is how silly I am. I was with some friends that had come to Las Vegas, and they were playing slot machines, which is not a good bet. Just want to let you know. They were playing slot machines. And so I was nearby them, and I was very bored. So I pulled one of the chairs up to an ATM machine, sat down in front of it, and every time I took $100 out, I yelled, "I can't believe I won again." And people around me were looking at me, watching me in front of an ATM machine, believing that I thought I was winning money when I was just depleting my own account. I thought that was pretty funny. That's how silly I actually am.
That is good.
You like that?
Yeah, that is good. I'm going to do that.
Now, let me tell you something. I wish it was videoed. I wish it was videoed because I was really acting goofy. And, you know, I was throwing money in the air. You know, I was taking my two or three hundreds and throwing them in the air and then putting my card in again. And I just, this is fantastic, you know. And, you know, people were giving me a look. And one of my friends was just in tears, you know. So...
I have to party with you, David Williams.
I'm telling you, it's good. I've been trying to tell you people. I invite people out here. We have a great old time. You just got to find out how silly I really am, though. It's a little embarrassing.
If you were in Vegas, it's on tape somewhere.
It is. It is on tape somewhere. That is true. And they keep those tapes for a gosh darn long time.
Mike G. Has a question for you, David. What are your thoughts on the dwindling volume in the market over the last few years? And how does that affect your market forecasting?
Did you say Mike Reed asked that, or who asked that?
No, Mike G.
Oh, Mike G. I'm sorry. I would be surprised if Mike Reed was asking me a question like that, because he knows about, you know, markets and stuff. The dwindling volume in the market. Let me think about that, because I don't know if I have a lot to say about it that would be meaningful. I know about it. I know the market volume has dwindled. It has not affected... I'll tell you, I will say this, that the market has made, recently, at least maybe in the last year or maybe year and a half, it has been not as easy for me to find certain kinds of setups that I'm used to, that I see a lot of or have seen a lot of in the last 20 plus years. They've kind of just disappeared. And I've often scratched my head about that and said, well, you know, how come it just doesn't, and I used to be able to have two or three of these things literally in many cases per day. These were really high quality setups. I see less of those now than I've seen in previous years. It's possible that your question about volume, that may be the answer. That the lower volume has changed enough of the characteristics of the market so that for this period of time, it's harder to find those kinds of setups. I know what I'm looking for, just like we all do. We all have our setups that we're looking for. Some people who developed their skill set came to fruition in a low volume market. They may be finding all kinds of setups for them in this market, and then when the volume returns, they may sound like me now, saying I'm seeing less of the kinds of setups because I was, you know, brought up in a much more active and much more volatile market. Markets get more volatile as they go higher, and that's a general truth about all markets. But I remember the market being more volatile than recent years when the market was down at 400. So even though the ranges were smaller, the activity of the market, the volume of the market, the surging in the market, the explosiveness of the market was much better at those lower levels for certain periods of time. And it's been really good over a long period of time since then, but I agree that maybe the answer to your question is that one of my questions to myself has been, how come I'm not seeing as many of these certain types of setups is relatable to volume? I don't know for sure, but that's probably my best answer that I can give. So I hope that's usable there for you. Let's see. Natural gas, I don't have a lot to add to that right now, although I think we're close to a daily bottom in natural gas here. I don't have everything up on that. Let's just take a quick look around, see if there's anything else of interest. And, you know, I can tell that also just from our perspective, the markets are quiet because our phone isn't ringing as much from institutional people as it normally is right now because it's slow enough that they're not interested in putting a trade together. So we're seeing that. And so the slowness of the market, you know, is a part. Now, looking at the hours today, it looks like a really big, fast-moving day. Take a look at your hourly chart. Like, wow, they really that was explosive. But it really wasn't. It's just very slow, very, you know, quiet, persistent, trending, and that's about all we can say about it right now. We are, you know, we do expect higher prices, as we talked about earlier. So there you are. The market's really big. It's as big as life. Every part of it changes. Every part of it has nuance to it. It's one big happy thing with a whole lot of little details. And you can find your way around those details. And even if the market is 100% efficient because of the quants and the people grinding away at the last bit of efficiency, I'm here to tell you there's other ways to skin the cat. There's no two ways about it. And when whatever my method is, for me, when that runs its course in due time, there's another way after that. And so on, and so on, and so on. So that's excuse me. That's why I've always said how important it is to have a number of different methods that you come to the table with, so that you can take advantage of what the position of the market happens to be doing at this particular time. You won't have enough tools to trade every single little thing, perhaps, as a technician. But you know, three or four tools under your tool belt is a really good thing to have. Very helpful. You know, three or four different ways to look at the market, three or four different approaches. In my particular case, you know, turning points is a big thing for me. Well, that's one thing. And then, you know, the roadmaps is another. And then I have a few other things that I play with, something called squares. And, you know, these kinds of things allow the market to do whatever it wants to do, and I may be able to find my little piece of the river in there. So, yeah, I could go on, but I won't tie us up on all that. So, anyway, Duane, I think that's it. Listen, it was a pleasure today to talk to this fellow. I actually go back a long way with him. I didn't like his – I read his book when I – back then. I felt the same way that I did now. I didn't like his position on that. But it is very nice – it was really nice for me to – because I go back so long. This, I think I read his book in 1992 or something. So it was 20 years ago when I read Random Walk Down Wall Street. And that was the beginning of my market career. And here I am on a radio program speaking to the author, thanks to the radio, to you. And we all talked about wanting to get him on. The nature of the conversation was such that we're really not going to be able to go into a lot. We would have to get much closer to him to be able to go into more detail with this stuff. But like I said before, I thought he handled himself very well, and I didn't get the slightest feeling that he was, for me, I didn't get the slightest feeling of, you know, looking down upon technicians or any of that stuff. He stated his position. He was genuine about it. And I really appreciate that because of my background coming with a bunch of people who are just snobs, to be quite blunt.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we're glad we could enrich your life a little bit today. That's why we are here.
Yeah.
That's why we do
that
what we
do. That worked out well.
So, all right. If that's it, that's all. Whatever. Oh, right, Robin, where are you? You never typed anything in today. Are you not with us today? Let me look. If you are, you were mighty quiet. Maybe you didn't get the notice that we were over into our regular time now. I don't see her in the audience.
She might have missed that.
Okay. All right, then. Well, David, thanks so much. I didn't play your intro, but I'll certainly be happy to play your outro.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for the question, guys, and I'll be here tomorrow. I look forward to it, and I really enjoyed it today, Dwayne.
All right.
Talk to you guys
then.
Tomorrow.
Guys, that's going to do it for us as well. A reminder, if you are a CFRN partner meeting tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, your link should be in your email inbox by 5 p.m. Eastern. The meeting's at 9, but you should have your invitation and link by 5 p.m. Eastern. If it's not in your inbox, send an email to support@cfrn.net. If you've been on the free trial, you've kicked the tires, you've turned over the rocks, and you want to become a partner, you should have an email with a link that you can click to become a partner. It's that simple. If somehow that email has escaped you, or you would like such an email, just send an email to support at CFRN.net that says, I'd like to be a partner. We'll send you the paperwork. You can get it all filled out, and we'll make sure that you are in the meeting with us tonight. Okay? And if you haven't taken the free trial, go to CFRN.net/apply. It's that simple. And then join us tomorrow morning in the live trading room. And this afternoon, you'll get your platform and your charts and your indicators going and your data flowing, and you'll be ready to rock and roll tomorrow. That's it. Thanks so much for tuning in. Whoever you are, wherever you are, may God continue to richly bless you with His mercy and with His grace. And I'll see you at the bell.
Remember this, there is no greater return on investment than to see a human life changed and given hope. As always, pray hard and trade safe. Any financial information discussed on this show is simply the opinion of our host, Dwayne Reeves, his co-hosts, and guests. To learn more about trading e-mini futures or to take a one-week free trial in our live trading room, call 1-866-928-3310. 866-928-3310. Information discussed on this radio program should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Always do your own due diligence and consult with a licensed securities broker or financial planner before making any investment decision.